welcome to another edition of Homespun C-SPAN. In honor of a confluence of several events, we bring you Greta Harris, Senior Program Director of LISC, which is an acronym standing for Local Initiatives Services Corporation. Greta Harris is speaking at the University of Richmond on affordable housing. According to LISC.org, the Local Initiatives Services Corporation provides grants, loans, and equity investments to CDCs. CDC is an acronym for Community Development Corporations, which are nonprofits formed to rehabilitate neighborhoods and houses. When LISC begins a new program, National LISC matches locally raised funds and gives that much more to the community for renovation. The CDC then designates the funds to a variety of projects that will best suit the neighborhood, and then renovation begins. Critics have considered LISC to be an acceleration of gentrification and efforts to reduce citizen input by replacing said citizens with large corporate or government redevelopment that is disempowering and tends to homogenize neighborhoods. Barely a year ago, the City Council of Richmond chose to spend $12 million of your tax money for tax abatement incentives, plus an additional $3 million, according to the Virginia Business Magazine, to subsidize two bridges to a condo development called Riverside on the James. This is just a few hundred feet upriver from the Vistas on the James, a different condo development that just sold condos that don't yet exist for $600,000. The Richmond Times-Dispatch cites the developer as being amazed that people were that willing to pay for views of the James River. If you remember Ralph White, who recently spoke downtown and was covered on Homespun C-SPAN, you know why people are paying so much. Thanks to people like Ralph White and the volunteer bikers, hikers, boaters, and fishermen that helped preserve a bit of wild in the city, Richmond has one of the most awesome urban river parks in the world. I know I paid about an additional $40,000 to buy a house close to the James River Park. That said, Alan Greenspan is leaving, just as Greenspan himself cited indications that some say foretells the popping of the housing bubble. The federal government has considered changing the tax regulations that may reduce the value of your house as a tax write-off. One article recently speculated these changes could drop house prices 15%. So since wages are so conspicuously not keeping up with the inflation in real estate, here is Greta Harris speaking October 7, 2005, on the subject of affordable housing.
Thank you very much for inviting me here, Amy. And we have about 15 to 20 minutes, and I'm going to go through a quick PowerPoint just to let you know a little bit about our work. And I'm really looking forward to the dialogue afterwards to just have some back and forth a little bit about the complexities and of the issues that we try to deal with, not only in Richmond, but across the country. Really short presentation. Even though we're known, and I'm here and I'm going to be talking about affordable housing, our organization and the partners that we work with are involved in community development, of which affordable housing is one of several strategies that we employ to ultimately help improve the quality of life in low-wealth communities across the nation. And so I wanted to give you a little context about why the community development industry was created to begin with, then talk about the roles of CDCs or community development corporations, and if you don't understand the context for why community development got started or the role of CDCs, then there's no reason for LISC to be here because these folks are our customers. First, we want to talk about history. And while history certainly shouldn't be a determinant for what your future is going to be, I think it does deem some reflection and respect so that we can be smarter about how we shape the next steps going forward into our future. After World War II, as our vets were coming home, there were this whole new development, strategy of suburbs. Up until that point, we really didn't have them. Most people in America lived in the urban centers. But as people were coming back, suburbs were being created, and in order to connect the suburbs to the central business districts in the cities, there was this expansion of highway development all over the country. There used to be all these little two-lane highways that we still see, but there were the superhighways, 8, 10, 12-lane highway systems that were connecting American central business districts in suburban areas across the country. As those highway systems were being developed, trying to determine where they would be located ended up more times than not going right through communities that were poor and generally communities that were made up of people of color. In Richmond, as an example, in 1950, I-95 was not going through downtown Richmond. And Jackson Ward, which some of you may know, was actually connected to where Gilpin Court is. You know, there's this big gouge that now goes through the city. That was actually filled in. And where Gilpin Court is located was part of Jackson Ward. The powers that be decided that I-95 would go through this area, and it impacted the Carver community, the Jackson Ward community, and what was Navy Hill, which is no more. And over 1,000 families who were working class families that paid their taxes, that sent their kids to school, lost their homes, businesses were destroyed, and the economic underpinning of those neighborhoods are still struggling today to come back. The design of the highway could have been moved a half a block north into Chaco Valley where the railroad tracks are, and nobody would have been disturbed that way. But what happened here in Richmond happened all over the country and really, again, destroyed the economic underpinning of many of our neighborhoods. As the suburbs, let me back up too, as the suburbs were being created, it really created the impetus for white flight out of the urban centers of our country. Those who had the opportunity and the economic means to move up and out did, and you started to see the browning of American cities at that point. But still, there was economic diversity because there were high-end, middle-class, and lower-income people of color who were living in the urban areas. But soon in the late 1960s, early 1970s, there was another series of flight out of the urban areas, and those were people of color who had economic means. So what you ended up having were concentrated pockets of poverty, mainly people of color who were left in the urban centers. You had highways that were now coming through these neighborhoods, sort of disrupting the normal economic functioning of those communities. And people with economic means and disposable cash to help support business development were living out in the suburbs. Simultaneously, you had this new thing called urban renewal that was happening. And this was a public policy, you know, as the inner cities were starting to deteriorate because there weren't as many public services and all being put back into the city. We said, well, we're going to tear down this whole, not just a few blocks, but sometimes whole neighborhoods. I worked in North Philadelphia for a number of years, and there are still areas in North Philadelphia from 1955 that still haven't been rebuilt. And they tore it down and said that we'll come back and put something back there. In some cases, it has been rebuilt. In other cases, it really hasn't. You also had the creation of public housing, which is never meant as a perpetual housing for lower-income families, but it was really transitional housing to help people who were down on their luck. They could have a place to stay, get themselves together, and move up and out. But what you ended up having was people staying there generationally sometimes. And public housing was located typically in lower-income communities of color. Again, here in Richmond, we have about 4,000 public housing units in the city of Richmond. The average income of most of the residents is under $10,000 a year. That's a household income, and that you're trying to operate and function with that amount of money. 2,000 of the units, or 50% of them, are located just in one neighborhood in Church Hill. So when you have that concentration of that poor a population, there are all sorts of socioeconomic issues that begin to ripple out into the broader community. And on top of that, you had private capital redlining. And all that means is that banks and insurance companies would put a map of a neighborhood or of a city, of a region on the map, and they take a red line or red pen and circle the areas based on race and based on income, and say that those areas are too high risk for us to invest our capital. And they would take your deposits and they would take your insurance premium payments, but then they would not cover people that resided in those areas or support businesses that were located there. And this disparity of haves and have-nots started boiling over, and people were so frustrated that civil unrest and riots started, and we ended up starting to see in the 50s and 60s the beginning of the civil rights movement that ended up happening. And I think when all is said and done, and I've been at this for about 18 years now, and I've gotten a chance to go into some of the most exclusive areas of communities in New York and Philly and here in Richmond, and I've been in some of the poorest and most impoverished communities. And I think what I have learned from public housing residents in Camden or residents in Newark or parts of folks who are living in the Bronx or even here in Richmond is that even though you may be poor, people have the same hopes and aspirations as anybody else, irrespective of what your income is. They want a better quality of life for themselves and for their kids. And they may not be well-educated, they may not be articulate in how they express themselves, but they're very intelligent and very thoughtful about trying to do better for themselves and their families. And unfortunately, a lot of perceptions that we all have sometimes would think that people don't care, but they do in a lot of different ways. So as the civil rights movement was coming forward and trying to promote more equitable public policy from the highest echelon of government, what we had was this community development movement and where community residents and business owners came together and said, we can't count on government, we can't count on the private sector, we can only count on ourselves to come back and really try to transform liabilities into assets. And probably the first CDC that was created was in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which is in Brooklyn in New York. The gentleman who started that organization, Franklin Thomas, moved on to become the first black president of the Ford Foundation, and I was honored to get a chance to meet him last week in Washington. And basically, what we wanted to try to do in this community development movement is just, again, create that better quality of life both for existing residents as well as new residents coming into the area. Some of the tenets of community development include that just like this table is full with a variety and diverse group of people, that the residents who are most impacted by decisions that are going to be made, whether public policy decisions or private capitalization decisions, that they sit at the table along with public leadership as well as private leadership and have a voice at crafting the strategies going forward. By organizing the community residents, you end up having a constituent base that can promote advocacy and promote good public policy. This work only is successful if you have community, public, and private sitting at the table. The community residents know the issues and probably the solutions better than anybody else because they're living it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The public sector has the role of creating good public policy that is just and equitable to all the citizens of this country, and they have critical capital like we're trying to see making its way down to the Gulf Coast to seed private sector activities and philanthropic activities coming in. And honestly, the private sector is probably one of the most critical partners in here because there will never be enough public or philanthropic dollars to address fully the socioeconomic issues of our country. It's only when those communities are operating in the true economic capital flows and private markets are back in these neighborhoods that we'll see true systemic change.
You are listening to WRIRLP's Civic Revival on Homespun C-SPAN, today featuring Greta Harris, the Senior Program Director of LISC. Greta Harris is speaking at the University of Richmond on October 7, 2005 on affordable housing.
We try to be targeted in our resources and we try to be thoughtful because there have been lots of examples over the years where people with very good intentions who were clueless, honestly, about what really was going on in the community, but come in and say, well, I think we ought to do this, and they miss the point. So we try to be thoughtful in how we're doing this in some very, sometimes very complex issues, and again, trying to attract private market flows back into these communities. If we do quality affordable housing and other asset building, then we end up creating healthy communities, and that's our goal in community development. CDCs, and this is great because I see potential, you know, hirees and other new customers coming into the community development corporations. And let me just say, as someone who has been in the nonprofit arena for way too long, you don't have to take a vow of poverty to work for a nonprofit anymore. You aren't going to be wealthy, but you can feel good about yourself most days in the work that you're doing because you're impacting the quality of life of some of our neighbors, which is, honestly, it's one of the coolest things when you hand the keys over to somebody who never thought that they could own a home or start a business, and you've played a small role in helping them to realize their dreams. It's neat stuff. So CDCs are nonprofit real estate developers. They typically work in underperforming markets. All that means is that the private market wouldn't touch most of the areas that we go into. In real estate, the old adage is location, 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 and we go right where the market says we shouldn't. It doesn't make economic sense to do what we do. It doesn't make sometimes logical sense, but it certainly is morally absolutely where we should be. We provide this forum for residents and other public-private partners to come together and craft strategies. And the goal is to set the stage so that private capital will come back into these communities. This is not a great graphic, but I'll try to explain it here. When we go into a neighborhood that's been economically distressed, and I'll give you an example in a second, generally the market values are really below what they should because there's been so little private investment over a number of years. In the Barton Heights area, which I don't know if you guys know, it's over in Northside, this was probably 10 or 12 years ago, we bought a shell of a house, big old house, beautiful wood floors, fireplaces, all this kind of stuff. Did that, renovated it, the total development cost was $92,000. When we went to go get a market appraisal, which is how you get your mortgage financing, it was only worth $52,000. And so nonprofits are uniquely positioned to fill that gap with philanthropic dollars and public sector money. And over time, as we continue to do more and more houses, the market value starts to actually mimic the actual development cost. And when the market value and development cost are on the same level, then the private market will begin to come back into those communities. And that's when a lot of work starts to be happening. Our role as an intermediary is that we help bring business acumen to grassroots efforts. And really try to put more business systems and accountability to the groups that we work with and help continue to bring the right people, ideas, and resources to the table. We try to use data, which Amy referenced, so that it's easy to use your gut, and sometimes that's a real good thing to use as well, but more and more trying to blend quantitative information with qualitative makes us smarter in how we're coming up with strategies to help rebuild neighborhoods. Our organization just celebrated its 25th anniversary. We actually were launched by the Ford Foundation as a 3-year demonstration project. And now we've been around for 25 years. We work in 37 urban areas. We work in 70 rural communities. And the numbers that I think as of the end of last year, we helped to facilitate $14 billion of real estate transactions across the country over the last 25 years. That equates to 160,000 units of housing. That equates to probably 200 child care centers, 100 charter schools, we've done health clinics, art centers, we have a partnership with the NFL, and we've done about 80 play fields in low-income areas. It's about trying to build on community assets and make these communities and targeted neighborhoods better places to live. We support CDCs. They are our customers. We also support for-profit developers who are willing to come into the communities where we work, and public housing authorities who have assets and resources that can be useful in rebuilding neighborhoods. Those are some of the stats again. Locally, we've been here since 1990. And in the South, the community development industry actually was slower getting started mainly, I think, because of some of our racial history here below the Mason-Dixon line. Places in the Northeast, New York, Boston, and in the Midwest, Chicago, Detroit, are much further along than we are. We were probably 20 years after the fact getting into the field. So when we first got here in 1990, people thought a CDC was the Center for Disease Control. So there really wasn't a big understanding and appreciation for why these little small nonprofits could be a force to be reckoned with. But we've raised $10 million thus far in our 15-year history here. We're in the middle of a $6.5 million fundraising campaign now. I was just telling Amy and John right before we got started that most of that money has come from white conservative Republican males. And I'd say probably 98-99% of the money has come from that source. I spend a lot of time fundraising, and most of the money has gone into lower-income, mostly Democratic, mostly Black communities. And John asked, why do you think people do that? And I think really at the end of the day, people want their community, our community, to be better for all of our citizens. And some people have different resources. Some have money. Some have intimate community knowledge. And when we work together, we can make significant things happen. And in Richmond, in neighborhoods like Blackwell, Highland Park, Barton Heights, Jackson Ward, Easton Henrico, Northern Chesterfield, along the Jeff Davis Corridor, we've done $250 million of real estate transactions in this community, in many communities that a lot of people are afraid to go into. But I've been humbled by the wisdom and the intellect of so many of the residents who reside there as we're trying to rebuild their communities. And now we're Virginia Lisk, and we're slowly moving into some other markets. But I want to keep on moving, and these are some of our expansion plans. We are not abandoning Greater Richmond. We are renewing our commitment to Central Virginia, but slowly moving our capital resources into other markets around the state. Here are the list of customers, high-performing CDCs, for-profit developers, and public housing authorities. And then I want to talk to you about a couple of strategies that we've used here in Richmond. How are we doing on time here? I need to wrap up in a few minutes. Okay, good. In Richmond, and you guys know this, the city proper is somewhere just under 200,000, the region just under 1 million, 3 independent, and the underscore independent government localities, cradle of democracy, great architectural housing stock. And, you know, in the last few years, over $4 billion of reinvestment. It's so exciting to be here and see what's going on in downtown. But we also have about 3,500 vacant and abandoned properties in many of the inner city neighborhoods. Our murder rate and overall crime rate is fluctuating, but for the size city that we are, it's way too high percentage. And our murder rate still, on a per capita basis, is more than New York City's. 80% of public school students qualify for free and reduced lunch, which means they're very poor. They're coming from poor households. This is our concentration of poverty map, and you can see the three jurisdictions, and where there is a concentration of 20% or more of poverty, you can see that 70% of that poverty is squarely located in the city of Richmond. And it is so difficult to function as a municipality when you have that disproportionate amount of people who are needing services, who are in depressed areas that don't generate a lot of real estate taxes, which is the main source of most local governments for providing good quality services and supporting schools. You can see that we're starting to see some slippage out into Eastern Henrico and starting in the northern end of Chesterfield County. And only now, as that poverty is slipping out into the suburban areas, are we starting to see those suburban leadership come to the table, because for such a long time, they said, we don't have an affordable housing issue, and really weren't willing to talk to us about how the strategies for how we could do things. We believe in a regional approach, a targeted approach, and deconcentrating poverty to improve the quality of life for the residents as well as surrounding communities. Two quick things that I'll run through. Neighborhoods in Bloom, you said that a lot of the students probably knew about that program. It's basically where we're targeting 80% of federal dollars into 7 areas rather than 24 areas. Basically, instead of getting a wet noodle amount of resources, a little sprinkling, we targeted. That was very much a political will process that was very inclusive. In a relatively short period of time, 400 new homeownership units were created through this effort. Crime dropped in the targeted areas. Property values increased 10% more per year than the city overall. And in every neighborhoods in Bloom community now, we're seeing private investors starting to come back into the markets. And it's beautiful housing that's going on there. It's very exciting to be a part of that. All of this in the city of Richmond. In Chesterfield County, there's a 40-acre development that was known as Parkley Apartments that used to get about 1,000 911 calls a year for murder, rape, drug activity. It was incredible. They looked like army barracks, and this is where over 500 children were living in this area, lots of vacant and abandoned units. One of our stellar CDC partners, Better Housing Coalition, went through a community planning process. They worked in partnership with the Chesterfield Police Department and got the bad element out of there. People were given vouchers and said, if you want to leave, you can, but if you want to stay and be a part of creating a new community, you can as well. About 60% of the existing residents stayed and are now a part of what's called Winchester Green. There are 240 units of rental housing that have won national award for their design and master planning. They are five-star energy efficient design and utility costs are less than $50 a month. There are about close to 300 units of senior housing. They're working on a new development of 100 homeownership units that will be green and sustainable, which is way cool. There's a child care facility for 140 children in the area, and now commercial development is starting to come. So this is what it used to look like. This is what some of the rental housing looks like now. And some of the senior housing, the daycare center.
So they tear all that down?
They did, but they did it in phases. And because we were fortunate enough to have acreage, they phased it in so no one got displaced in the process. Little child care centers, people said they wanted porches so they could sit out front and get to know their neighbors and watch their kids play. They said they needed a daycare center because most of the folks in Park Lee, before the transformation, their average income was $8,600 a year. Their average income now, and granted it's mixed income, so we have some higher income folks there, but there also is a social work program, so people are getting trained for better paying jobs. Average income is $18,500. And ultimately, that's the goal, because the more money you have, the more choices you have. Some of the other things that we do, we're getting more into, John would probably not say that it's actual, you know, rigorous research, but we're trying to use data and do more analytical research and so we can be smarter on the planning and implementation of our work. And we're reaching out to some unusual suspects like the Federal Reserve Bank and the Chamber of Commerce and the realtors to help us in trying to address very large and complex issues here. And ultimately, if we do our job well, private market flows will come back, we'll see crime reduced, and we'll see people moving into neighborhoods and people planting flowers and kids feeling safe to play out on the streets and our neighborhoods just becoming better places to call home. That's what we're shooting for. We have some great success under our track record, but there's much more work to be done. But that's what LISC and community development is, at least going on in this community.
Thank you, Greta. That was great. And I've got a big group here, so I hope we can enjoy our question and answer.
I'm your host, Christopher Maxwell, thanking you for listening to another installment in your Civic Revival. We have to go now, but we hope this will spark conversations that will go on. There is a question and answer session that followed Greta Harris's speech at the University of Richmond on October 7, 2005. The topic was affordable housing. Greta Harris is the Senior Program Director of LISC, which is an acronym standing for Local Initiative Services Corporation. Tune in again for the question and answer session on Homespun C-SPAN every Monday at high noon on WRIR. And thanks to you, WRIR is America's largest community LPFM and started with no government, no foundation money. WRIR is 100% all you, and so we thank you for our fall fundraiser drive.